Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
Thank you for joining us for episode 46 of Pepperdine People. I'm Craig Detweiler, Director of the Center for Entertainment, Media, and Culture. And I am joined today by two distinguished guests who are theologians, ordained churchmen, who have bridged the perceived gap between science and theology. Pepperdine is hosting the almost 500 Christian scholars this week here from universities all across America and the world. Our topic is the path of discovery, science, theology, and the academy. And our guests are hopefully going to help us understand how rigorous science actually strengthens and deepens faith. Reverend Dr. John Polkinghorne combines theological inquiry and scientific investigation. His books include The Faith of the Physicist and Belief in God in an Age of Science. And after serving as a professor of mathematics at Cambridge, he resigned to pursue theological studies, and he's now ordained in the Anglican Church. Dr. Ted Peters is a professor of systematic theology at Pacific Lutheran Seminary and the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. He served as the principal investigator for the National Institute of Health Project on theological and ethical questions raised by the Human Genome Initiative. He's written books on genetics, issues of social justice, the stem cell debate, and he is a Lutheran theologian and an ordained pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Thank you, gentlemen. We're so glad to have you here.
Good morning, Fred.
Good to be here.
So with the advent of the internet and all this information, you know, we're somewhat overloaded, particularly with scientific information, and it's hard to keep up with all these studies and the ethical decision-making, particularly in bioethical decisions. It's really tough whether you're a pastor, an educator, or just a person just trying to figure it out. How do we navigate this brave new world?
I think we have to navigate it in two steps. We have to rely on the experts to tell us what the options are, what can be done, what might be the side effects of doing it. But once they've done that, their role is finished. They're not judges in their own cause. Then it's for the ethically responsible public to seek to decide not only what can be done, but whether it should be done. That's the critical question. We need to try and do that, if possible, before the technology is finally on the shelf.
That's actually a circular relationship to some degree, because the public is going to decide what the government is going to fund and not fund. So there needs to be an interaction between the experts on the one hand and you and I who make a contribution to public policy on the other.
Well, you know, Pepperdine is a university. What are the challenges? I mean, we're having this conference kind of to explore these issues. What role does a Christian university play in this almost distinctly American discussion that we're having on science and religion?
Well, I think the university plays the role of standing for the unity of knowledge. Universities are not just loose federations of individual research institutes. They are seeking the truth in the widest possible context in the deepest possible way. And that's a very important role that universities have to play.
I like what John said about the unity of knowledge. They're universities, not multiversities. And the Christian mind has, from the New Testament on, always been an inquiring mind. It's no accident that Western Europe gave birth to natural science the way it did. St. Anselm and others have said the Christian faith seeks understanding, and through understanding, our appreciation for God's creative work in this universe grows and grows. The university should reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a tendency, I think, certainly through maybe the American press, to put science and faith in opposition to each other, the kind of an either-or thing that a lot of people feel they have to make a choice. And yet, you know, Dr. Polkinghorne, I remember in your talk yesterday, you were, I think, talking about the questions that science and faith can answer that are maybe different questions.
Yes, I think that science and religion are friends and not foes. And they're friends because they have the same basic orientation. They're both seeking the truth and looking for truth through motivated beliefs. But of course, they're looking for different dimensions of the truth. Science is asking the question of how things happen in the world, very important. but it makes its progress by bracketing out other questions, such as meaning and value and purpose in what's going on. And those are the sort of questions that religion is able to address. And I think if we're going to see the whole scene, we need the insights of science, insights of religion. I like to say I'm two-eyed. I see the world with the eye of science and with the eye of religion. And that binocular vision enables me to see further and deeper than either eye would on its own.
It's beautiful, and that's the kind of challenge I think we don't maybe hear enough of. Dr. Peters, as a theologian, I mean, you're educating the next generation of pastors, and yet, you don't fear this scientific inquiry. How do you sort of put those things together?
No, I don't fear scientific inquiry. In fact, I celebrate it. I read science and I read nature, and when they announce a new discovery, I get all excited about that. This creation is big and it's beautiful and it's magnificent, and the scientists are in some ways the revealers of what's going on. I noticed when you opened, you said there's a perceived split between science and religion. Yes, when journalists try to write articles, they want to play up the fight. But deep down, have you ever found a Christian who says, I don't like science? I don't think they exist. The same with our Jewish brothers and sisters. We all love science. So if there's a battle, it's really not that somebody is opposed to science. They might have a battle over an issue, but it's not really healthy to describe it as science versus anti-science, I think.
Hmm. Well, you know, Francis Collins was with us yesterday and talking extensively about evolution and sort of this, Darwin obviously has been branded with a broad brush, but Reverend Polkinghorne, you know, in England, the battle hasn't been drawn in sort of the same kinds of ways.
No, when an Englishman comes to North America, it's a slightly baffling scene. I mean, there are, of course, fundamentalists of one sort or another back at home, but they're not by any means as visible as they are in this country. And it sort of saddens me to see a country where there are many religious believers who I think are sincerely seeking to serve the God of truth, but who reject the truth that science can offer. It doesn't offer you the whole truth, but it offers some of it. And we should receive that with gratitude and respect, not with fear and trembling. Mm-hmm.
The battle that happens in North America is almost always, correct me if I'm wrong, over evolution. Mm. I've never heard anybody fight over chemistry or mathematics or physics. Can you imagine a chemist coming home after a day at the laboratory saying to his wife, oh, I just had an experiment today that's shaken my faith. I mean, it doesn't happen. The real battle is over Darwinian evolution, and that appeared in the history books in the late 19th century, and it's had enormous ramifications both for the authority of the Bible on the one hand, and social Darwinism, the support for capitalism, for example, comes from social Darwinism and that sort of thing. And there's a battle going on. But usually those people who are opposed to Darwinism are not necessarily opposed to chemistry, physics, and mathematics.
Mm. I like the way you reframe that. I put together a session yesterday called Playing God, and we looked at science fiction films and talked about things like Blade Runner and AI, artificial intelligence, The Matrix. And they suggest that we're sort of entering maybe a post-human moment where, humans and machines and the gap between those things are shrinking. Some would call this transhumanism. How should Christians think about this technology and this movement, do you think?
They should think carefully and soberly, I think. I mean, there's a certain amount of gee whiz going around about the power of implants to turn us all into geniuses overnight. We need to be careful. As I said a little bit earlier in our conversation, we need to assess possibilities before the technology is on the shelf. And there are certain forms of enhancement, which it seems to me are much to be desired, but other forms of enhancement which are really manipulative, shaping people to what you want them to be. And that's where you need to be very wary of that.
Yeah. I separate the issues of playing God on the one hand and transhumanism on the other. As Dr. John just said, certainly certain enhancements through bioengineering or perhaps even electronic implants in the future will improve human health and well-being. But the agenda to advance evolution by creating a post-human species that's more intelligent than we are is founded on a number of assumptions, as John says, we want to be sober about. For example, one assumption is that evolution is progressive, ever leading to more intelligence. Is that really true? And well, Christians have been very critical of the doctrine of progress in the past, and I think it's time to be critical again. So we should accept the blessings that bioengineering will deliver, but let's not pretend that somehow or other we're working out the purposes of the universe by creating a post-human, more intelligent species. I'm going to be sober about that one.
Well said. You know, in your book, Sacred Cells, you mentioned sort of the ethics where you were working with a private corporation, and yet you couldn't maybe share some of that information with your seminary students. You know, how does that work? I mean, we as the public, we maybe don't really understand what's going on, and a lot of it seems veiled and hidden. How much should we know? How much should we read? How does all that work?
This was an unusual situation for those of us who are bioethicists because working in a university setting, all knowledge is open and it's free. And then suddenly we had to embargo it. That didn't sit very well. And so we look forward to the day in which we could speak critically and publicly. Yeah, that was a little bit odd. And we asked ourselves, well, should we work for a corporation? And, okay, maybe we should quit. And then they would have no ethical counsel. Well, which is better, to stay there and offer our expertise or not? So we did. It lasted for about 4 years. It was a great adventure. Whether we helped the Geron Corporation or not, I don't know. You'll have to ask them. But at least we felt like we were understanding the science, and then eventually we could report it in public policy discussions in a way that was accurate. We thought that was a plus. I don't think it was a perfect arrangement.
I mean, the law of patenting is supposed to safeguard legitimate rights in inventions, but not to fail to allow people to have access to knowledge, to actual discovery. And that's an important distinction to make. Therefore, the Human Genome Project, for example, is very insistent that genetic, as you know, of course, Ted, the genetic sequences themselves should not be patented, though, of course, they might lead to therapeutic procedures, which then would be perfectly legitimately patentable.
The issue of patenting or intellectual property is very important. And as John was saying, Francis Collins, who headed the public side of the Genome Initiative, said no patenting. Craig Venter, who was representing private capital, he wanted a patent for profit. And it was really quite an interesting battle, to be sure. Here in California, we have Proposition 71 written right into that voter-approved measure is no patent of upstream, that is to say, primary knowledge about genetics, it will be permitted. So I'll ask an investigative reporter, check this out. Let's find out whether or not we're doing what the voters had asked us to do or not.
Well, I'm excited to see where all of this leads. It's such a dynamic moment. Maybe as a final question, you know, you're both familiar with each other's work and your contributions to the development of this science and religion dialogue, both in the U.S. and in the U.K. and throughout the world. So, you know, what would be some things that you appreciate about each other's work, what they've brought to the table? In other words, you know, Reverend Polkinghorne, what do you think of, you know, Dr. Peters? And Dr. Peters, what do you think of Reverend Polkinghorne?
Can I write you a check? How do you spell Polkinghorne?
Well, I'm very pleased to see people like Ted. The dialogue between science and religion, a lot of it is being conducted from the science side, which is the side, of course, I come from. And we have things to offer. But it's very important that mainstream theologians are involved. There are not enough of them, but Ted's a very striking and important example of someone who has taken on that task very seriously and very successfully.
What I appreciate about John's work, and if you had to list the 3, 4, 5 leading thinkers in the world in this field today, John's right up there on the top, and he's constructed a whole worldview, understood in terms of God as creator, Jesus Christ as Savior, and the promise that a new creation is coming. He's constructed that whole worldview, showing it's how you can integrate science at every one of those points. So in some ways, it's his breadth of integration that he's done better than almost anybody else.
Hmm. Well, we are in such a technological moment with so many ethical implications that we are really grateful that here we have Christians on the leading edge of whether we're talking about quantum physics, stem cells. We desperately need leaders in this area. So thank you for both diving into that and bringing it to us in a way that we can process and understand. Anything else we should know about the science and religion tension?
Hooray for Pepperdine. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, and thanks very much for this opportunity, this conversation. The more we discuss these things in the open, the more we're likely to find the right way ahead.
Thank you so much. I'm Craig Detweiler. This was the Pepperdine People Podcast.